Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
New Scientist from the 11th of August, just reading through for cardiac rehabilitation. The editorials at the start, leaders, programmed to fail. Our network world needs better approaches to cybersecurity. It was an innocent mistake with huge consequences. Robin Sigelman was a programmer working on OpenSSL, a software library used to make secure connections over the internet. In 2014, it emerged that a tiny area of his, likened to misspelling Mississippi, and all but invisible to 400,000 odd lines of code, had allowed the world's hackers to the servers of Google, Amazon, Facebook's Tumblr, and more, exposing sensitive personal data, including credit card numbers and passwords. It's not Sigelman's fault, more just one of many indictments to splash of our slapdash approach to computer security. It took 2 years before anyone noticed the bug, dubbed Heartbleed. By then, it was affecting pretty much every server in the world. The only solution was to patch the software and hope for the best. That's not good enough. This year, the World Economics Forum listed cyber attacks and data fraud in its top five most likely global risks alongside extreme weather, natural disasters, and failure to tackle climate change. It estimated that cyber attacks will cause $8 trillion worth of losses in the coming 5 years. As critical infrastructure becomes more and more interconnected, potentially even your kettle and toaster in the Internet of Things ever truly becomes reality, we create more points of vulnerability that can be exploited. It's time to call on the era of digital sticking plaster. That is the software patch. More effective ways of protecting network society exist at the level of computer hardware. See page 36. They would require an overhaul of the way we do computing and are unlikely to be a panacea. But the price of innocent mistakes allowed by our current software-based way of security is simply too high. Second editorial, allergies aren't nuts. Lovers of nuts and freedom suffered a blow on the 1st of August when the US budget carrier Southwest Airlines went peanut-free. While many peanut parents of children with allergies expressed thanks, other people took to the internet to announce they would be bringing their own supply from now on. If you were born before 1990s or don't have children, peanut bans by airlines, schools and workplaces can feel like a gross overreaction. Allergies may seem like modern maladies, but that does not make them any less real or life-threatening. This isn't simply a case of hypochondria or increased vigilance. Cohort studies that have closely followed different generations for decades confirm that hay fever, allergic asthma and food allergies have all risen since the mid-20th century in the developed world. Rapidly developed nations such as China are now beginning to see an increase in allergies too. The challenge is to work out why and dispel some of the many myths surrounding allergies. See page 28. In any time, whether afflicted or not afflicted, we must all learn to live with them. Antarctica's Shock New Loss by Michael Marshall, with the byline, two huge glaciers are rapidly melting. Two vast glaciers in eastern Antarctica have been losing mass rapidly since 2002. The finding means that our forecast of sea levels this century may have to be revised upwards, and we don't know how much. So far, most of the ice loss for Antarctica has come from the West Antarctica, and in particular the Antarctic Peninsula, which juts out to the sea and is exposed to warmer water. Okay, West Antarctica, I've got that one. The Larsen Sea ice sheet, which infamously cracked in 2017, is in West Antarctica. East Antarctica, that makes up two-thirds of the continent, was thought to be more stable because the strong winds spinning around Antarctica prevent hotter air from entering. So, although Antarctica, like every continent, is warming, it's unclear how much global warming is needed to melt the East Antarctica. One challenge of attempting to find out is East Antarctica's remoteness. Glaciologists have tried to estimate what is happening there, but for decades their measurements have been all over the place. In 2015, one team even claimed it was gaining ice. Adding to the confusion, the sea around Antarctica has grown in recent years, but the amount of ice is minuscule compared to that contained in the continent's ice sheets. And the sea has shrunk again over the past 2 years. To learn more about the true situation, Yara Mohajerani at the University of California, Irvine, and his colleagues focused on two vast East Antarctic glaciers called Troughton and Moscow University. As recently as 2015, a major survey of Antarctica's glaciers hedged its bet whether Troughton was shrinking, but evidence has accumulated since then. Calculations based on estimated snowfall and glaciers observed speed suggest it's losing mass. A study published in November 2017 examined the Troughton Ice Shelf, the region where the glacier meets the ocean and goes afloat. This found that it flowed into the sea faster between 2001 and 2006, when the water was a little warmer than usual, suggesting it was vulnerable. Then, in March this year, researchers announced that more of the glacier was floating than thought, meaning it was more exposed to warm currents. Quote, "We used multiple lines of evidence to confirm significant mass loss from Troughton and Moscow University glaciers," says Mohajerani. In particular, the team used data from the two GRACE, G-R-A-C-E, satellites, which measure local changes in the Earth's gravity. Less ice in the glacier means there's less mass and thus weaker gravitational field. Between 2002 and 2016, the two glaciers lost an average of 18.5 gigatons per year, team estimates. The glaciers hold enough ice to raise sea levels by 5 metres. Troughton alone could cause a 3-metre rise. It's extremely unlikely that amount of ice will emerge in this century, says Sudha Anandakrishnan of Penn State University. That's because it takes time for the warm water to eat its way back through the glacier. But while we probably won't see a 5-metre rise by 2100, we could get a lot, and we don't know how much. What's clear is that the previous uncertainty about the state of the East Antarctica was largely vanished, says Anandakrishnan. It's losing mass, and we has been for some years. Quote, "I think consensus is overly conservative and cautious," he says. At this point, quote, "the consensus is shifting quite strongly that East Antarctica is indeed losing mass," end of story. I like that. That's the end of the story here. Again, there's no author for this one. Hothouse Earth fears. Even if we stop pumping carbon dioxide into the atmosphere and limit global warming to 2 degrees, a cascade of tipping point may result in a warming of 4 to 5 degrees, warns a group of 16 climate scientists. With that would come an additional sea level rise of between 10 to 60 metres. That's just an expansion. For the most part, most of the past half billion years, the Earth has been much hotter than today, with no permanent ice at the poles. The hothouse Earth state. 3 million years ago, as CO2 levels fell, it began oscillating between two cooler states, ice ages, with great ice sheets covering much of the northern hemisphere and glacial periods like the present. If Stefan at Stockholm University in Sweden and his colleagues are right, we might be on the brink of pushing the planet out of the present interglacial state into a hothouse Earth state. This means that even if our greenhouse gases emissions ceased and we managed to limit warming by 2 degrees by 2100, we are currently on course for 3 to 4 degrees by then. Warming will continue over the next few centuries. A group argues that existing models underestimate warming by at least 0.5 degrees Celsius because they don't include all the feedbacks, such as less carbon being stored in the oceans or forests die back. As the Earth warms, more will be triggered. Extreme stresses, it is pointing out the risk that needs studying, not something that is certain to happen. Some climate scientists that the new scientist spoke to expressed skepticism at the claim, although others thought it was reasonable. Well, that really doesn't say very much, does it? Assassin drones fail to kill a president. Radio jamming systems apparently thwarted an attempt to presidential assassination with improvised drone bombs in Venezuela. On Saturday, the 4th of August, President Nicolas Maduro's speech at an outdoor rally was interrupted by two explosions. People scattered and bodyguards rushed to protect the president with bulletproof shields. Witnesses reported seeing two drones which crashed into a nearby apartment building and exploded. Several people were injured, said Nestor Revol, Venezuela's Interior and Justice Minister. He announced on television that the attack was carried out by two DJI Matrix 600 drones, a type widely used in filming, which are larger professional versions of the firm's popular consumer drones. Revol said each drone had been carrying a kilogram of C4 explosives that, quote, signaling inhibiting equipment, quote, caused one to fall short of its target and the other had crashed. In other words, the equipment was probably jammed of some kind. Another quake rocks Lombok. At least 98 people have died and thousands have been left homeless by powerful earthquakes on the Indonesian island of Lombok. Thousands of people are now sheltering in makeshift tents. Authorities say rescuers haven't yet reached all affected areas that expected the death toll to climb. It was the second deadly quake in a week that hit Lombok, a less developed island compared to that of the more famous neighbour Bali, where the tremors caused panic and damaged buildings. A quake on 29th of July killed 16 people and damaged hundreds of houses on Lombok, some of which collapsed. In Sunday's evening quake measured magnitude 6.9 on the U.S. Geological Survey, by the U.S. Geological Survey. In the mountains north of the island, more than half the homes were destroyed by severely damaged. Collapsed bridges, blocked, ruptured roads, and loss of power and communication have so far prevented rescuers from reaching some affected areas. I don't know what the science of that one is. The use of a powerful opioid rising in the UK. Now, I didn't know. I had some fentanyl I thought was great for my heart surgery, but here it goes. The drug fentanyl was behind 75 deaths in England and Wales last year, up 29% for the 58 in 2016. Fentanyl is a synthetic opioid that can be up to 100 times more powerful than morphine. And the new figures released by the UK Office of National Statistics on Monday also reveal that carfentanil, which is even stronger than fentanyl, was mentioned on the death certificates of the first time in 2017, accounting for 27 deaths. However, the deaths from most other opiates seem to be in decline. In 2017, there was a 4% decrease in heroin and morphine deaths, down from 1,164 people, the first drop in death from these drugs since 2012. Deaths from stimulant cocaine has risen for the 6th year in a row. In 2017, 432 people died of powdered or crack cocaine use, up 371 the previous years. This is quite lethal if you actually think of, it's not per population using drugs, this is an enormous amount of death. Overall, the level of drug poisoning deaths in England and Wales has remained stable from the previous year. This is Ellie Osborne of the Office of National Statistics. News and Technology section by Alice Klein. A secret of AI predicts football injuries. Football may be unpredictable, but its injuries often aren't. Artificial intelligence can work out when players are likely to get hurt so coaches can let them rest. A machine learning algorithm developed by data scientists at the University of Pisa, Italy and Barcelona Football Club recently predicted 9 out of the 14 injuries sustained by elite Italian football team during the single season. Alessio Rossi of the University of Pisa and his colleagues fitted the football team's 26 players with GPS sensors during the training sessions. These measured how far and fast they ran, how often they accelerated and decelerated, and the impact that they had with the ground and other players. They also recorded information about their age, height, weight and role on the field, injury history and minutes played in the last game. As the season progressed, the researchers' algorithms learned to detect patterns between these variables and the players getting hurt. By the end, it was able to predict 60% of the injuries. Coaches could use the algorithm to work out when they should rest the players or lighten their training loads, says Rossi. For example, a new Graves manager had known that Edison Cavani was at risk of injuring his calf during the recent World Cup match against Portugal. He would have replaced him sooner, said Rossi. Sports injury forecasters have been used in the past, but their precision is typically less than 5%, says Rossi. This is because they have usually relied on a single variable, like the number of balls, accurate bowler bowls, to predict injury risk, he says. Quote, they miss the power of combining different training workload measures, he says. Existing forecasting tools have been also hampered by a high false alarm rate, says Rossi. Stopping players unnecessarily is a condition clubs want to avoid, especially for key players. He says, the new forecast halves the rate of false alarms, he says. The Italian team that trialled the AI... What? Well, it was 95%. Oh, yeah, okay, right, I'll get that one. The Italian team that trialled AI can't be named because it doesn't want to give away competitive advantages, says Rossi. The name goes... The same goes for three other top-level European football teams that have started using it, he says. Rossi and his colleagues are now investigating whether they can increase the accuracy of predictions by including variables like heart rate and degree of sweating. They want to see whether they can predict the type of injury, although some will always be unpredictable following a bad tackle, for instance. Microsoft launched its own machine learning injury forecast in June last year, which uses GPS and heart rate data, as well as players' self-reported sleep, mood, and muscle soreness. It's been used in the US football team of Seattle Reign, Spanish football team Real Sociedad, the Seattle Seahawks NFL team, and the Australian cricket team. Oh, yeah. Their results are mostly confidential, but Seattle Reign says only one player got injured in the season after the team adopted the technology. Again, that's not very good scientific thing, because they're obviously interested in it, so there's other factors. Boy's brain works despite missing a chunk, by Alison George. A boy who had a large portion of his brain removed is still able to function normally, showing how adaptable our brains can be. The boy started having seizures from the age of 4 as a result of a tumour, leading to surgeons to remove a third of his brain right hemisphere just before his 7th birthday. This lobectomy exercised his right optical lobe, which carries out visual processing, and most of the temporal lobe, which deals with sight and sounds. No one knew how the boy's brain would recover after losing its visual centres. We usually have two, one in each brain hemisphere. Higher-order visual capabilities, such as recognising faces and objects, are mainly the job of the right hemisphere. 3 years after surgery, Marine Bell... at Carnegie Mellon University in Pennsylvania and her colleagues found that the boy's intellect, visual perception and recognition of faces were all normal for his age, but he can't see the whole visual field. He's essentially blind to information on the left side of the world, says Berman. It seems you need two hemispheres to have a full 183-degree vision. Well, the boy's ability to, quote, see the right-hand side of his brain is never recovered. The team found that his left hemisphere reorganized itself to take over the sophisticated tasks such as face and object recognition. This hemisphere is normally more involved with tasks like recognizing words. We saw a kind of jostling in the left hemisphere between regions engaged in word face recognition resolved and settled into a new organization, says Berman. It may be possible to recover these abilities because they were still developing at the time of the lobotomy, says Berman. Older people lose visual centers may not fare as well, she says. The boy says he wants to be a neurologist when he grows up. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you.
may you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.